Chapter 11. The Heroism of Recovery. After World War II, a long-standing philosophical debate over whether we have free will or are just the products of our environments gained real-world significance. Former Nazi officers on trial defended themselves by saying they were not responsible for their actions, including the operation of gas chambers, because they were following orders. Courts ruled that this was not a valid defense. And philosophers, including French existentialist Jean-Paul Sartre, gained worldwide fame in his emphasis on individual responsibility. "Man is condemned to be free," he writes. "From the moment he is thrown into this world, he is responsible for everything he does." Michel Foucault disagreed. Following the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, Foucault felt that individual responsibility was a myth used by powerful people to punish and discipline others for things they could not control. None of us chose our brains and bodies, our families and communities, or our places in time and space. How could we be said to have free will at all? The problem with this line of thinking is that people appear to behave far better when they take responsibility for their actions than when they don't. Subjects primed to disbelieve in free will are, for example, more likely to engage in aggressive behaviors. Disbelief in free will even seems to impair some cognitive processes. One way to think about free will is that it exists only as a belief. The more we believe in free will, the more it exists. The less we believe in it, the less it exists. "If you do call free will an illusion, it's a useful illusion, right?" said Corey Clark, a professor of social psychology, who is doing innovative research into how we think about freedom and responsibility. Thinking through, if I do X, Y will happen, is an important part of the process that leads to making better choices. If people thought they didn't have to do that, they might not make good choices anymore. But perhaps what's behind Clark's view is a desire to punish people who break the law. "I'm one of the least punitive people that I know," she said. "I do feel for prisoners. At the same time, I'm not prepared to relinquish the idea of responsibility." The lesson for anyone who cares about expanding human freedom, as opposed to trying to control others, is that we should be communicating to people that they have far more freedom, not less freedom, than they realize. The more you play the victim, the more of a victim you'll become. That was Jabari Jackson's experience. After he was arrested for the robbery, he blamed everyone else but himself. "I was mad," he said. "And after a while, you start believing the shit you tell yourself. In my mind, I was the victim. My ways was nowhere close to being why things are happening is happening. I'm the victim, I'm the victim. I played no part in this. You all are just taking this shit out on me." And after a while, you start believing your own bullshit. In the mid-1960s, psychologist Eric Byrne wrote a book that observed the ways in which we all unconsciously adopt roles in our relationships, whether with friends, family, or colleagues. Many dramas require a victim. One person plays the victim, another the persecutor, another the patsy, that is, a person who is fooled, and still another the rescuer. Crucially, we tend to develop role-playing patterns in our relationships, but we also switch roles as the situation changes. In a game Byrne called Alcoholic, he described the interactions between an alcoholic husband and his wife, who would role switch. At night, she played the patsy, undressing him, making him coffee, and allowing him to beat her. In the morning, she played the persecutor, berating him for the evil of his ways, and in the evening, the rescuer, pleading with him to change them. Our motivation in playing these roles, felt Byrne, is praise and recognition, which he called strokes. Notes Clark, when society says, "Oh, these people who've had these bad things happen to them are victims, and we should feel sorry for them and should do everything we can to help them," people come to learn that playing the role of the victim gets them favors. Scholars call such excessive compassion pathological altruism, defined as behavior in which attempts to promote the welfare of another or others results instead in harm that an external observer would conclude was reasonably foreseeable. The related idea that all white people are persecutors and all black people are victims locks all of us into terrible roles, argue some scholars. It is a formula that binds the victim to his victimization by linking his power to his status as a victim, wrote Shelby Steele in his 1990 National Book Award-winning book, The Content of Our Character. There is, lying at the heart of modern black American thought, wrote Columbia University linguist John McWhorter in his 2000 book Losing the Race, a transformation of victimhood from a problem to be solved into an identity in itself, and as an identity to be nurtured. It is today common, socially acceptable, and even rewarding for progressives to put others and themselves down for being white, male, and straight, and sometimes Asian, while elevating those in supposed victim categories to higher social, moral, and even spiritual status. Frankel, a victim of biology-based identity politics, attacked the notion of collective guilt after the war. In 1946, he said, "I lectured in the French occupation zone of Austria. I spoke against collective guilt in the presence of the commanding general of the French forces." Frankel insisted on individual, not group, responsibility. "We are responsible for our behavior, not the behavior of all black or white people, women or men." For many progressives, it is taboo to suggest people are on the street for any reason other than poverty. Journalists need to not frame this problem as people with meth addiction, Housing First advocate Margot Cashel said to me sternly at the end of our call. Part of the reason, as we have seen, is a determination to ensure that societal resources are spent on housing rather than addiction. But another motivation appears to be to downplay the notion that even victims can have responsibility for and control over their behavior. There are many versions of the persecutor-victim-rescuer game when it comes to homelessness. In the mind of many progressives, the homeless person is the victim, the police is the persecutor, and the social workers and activists are the rescuers. But sometimes the victim plays the persecutor the victim, and finally the victim the rescuer. In the fall of 1993, as I was walking up 16th Street toward Mission Street in San Francisco, a man who appeared to be homeless gripped the neck of a woman, holding her head against a wall and punching her in the face. Every time he did, her head slammed against the wall behind her. She was bawling and bloodied. I stopped about 15 feet away from them and stared, unsure what to do. Several people walked quickly by me without stopping. "Hey," I shouted. "What the fuck do you want?" the man screamed at me, never taking his hand off her neck. He appeared significantly stronger than me. "Fuck off." At that moment, a coworker, who was both taller and stronger than me, came up behind me and said, "Hey, you grab him from behind and I'll grab him from the front." Before giving me a chance to respond, he swung his tote bag full of books at the man's stomach. Without thinking, I bear-hugged the man from behind, pinning his arms against his body as hard as I could, while my friend grabbed the man by the lapels. But as soon as we did, the woman started screaming at us to let the man go. I was struck by how quickly she switched from victim to rescuer, recasting her persecutor into our victim. "Fuck both of you then," said my friend, switching from rescuer to patsy, as he let go of his shirt. I, too, then released the man and joined my friend in walking away, the couple still screaming obscenities at us after we turned the corner. In the fall of 1978, a relatively conservative member of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, Dan White, resigned from his post. He felt disappointed and discouraged from constantly losing battles to Harvey Milk and the emerging progressive majority on the board. White had also grown to resent the significant pay cut that he took from leaving his job as a firefighter to become supervisor. He was under stress from both him and his wife working side jobs and resigned abruptly from the board without consulting or informing his supporters in advance. After they reacted negatively to his decision, White tried to withdraw his resignation, but it was too late. White's resignation gave Mayor George Moscone the chance to appoint a progressive and for them to have a majority. Milk urged him to seize it. Angry and spiteful, White snuck into City Hall and shot and killed both Milk and Moscone. The murders were premeditated. White had overheard Milk lobbying the mayor to replace him. White used hollow point bullets to maximize damage to the body and carried extras so that he could reload. He fired into the heads of both Moscone and Milk at point-blank range, splattering their brains against the floor and wall. Before White shot Milk, he sounded like a child. "Why do you want to hurt my name, my family?" he said. "You cheated me." The jury found White guilty of voluntary manslaughter and acquitted him of first-degree murder, which meant he would be released from prison in under 5 years. The reason for the light sentence was a combination of prejudice and compassion. In court, White claimed he had been in a state of diminished mental capacity due to stress and junk food. He was, he claimed, a victim. The jury appeared to pity White. What seemed to be particularly influential was a recording of White breaking down in tears during his confession to the police. "My wife's got to work long hours," he said, sobbing. 50 and 60 hours, never see my family." White described how mean Milk had been. Cried White, "He just kind of smirked at me as if to say, too bad, and then I just got all flushed and hot and I shot him," said a homicide detective. "When I heard that confession, I said, this better be tried right in the courtroom, because if not, he'll walk." Playing the victim, or what researchers call victim signaling, appears to be working better than ever. Society's definition of trauma and victimization is broadening, researchers find. As a result, there are more people who identify as victims today, even as actual trauma and victimization are declining. Researchers find that people are increasingly moral typecasting, or creating highly polarized categories of victim and perpetrator. And they find that people who portray themselves as victims believe they will be better protected from accusations of wrongdoing. In one study, participants judged how responsible an imaginary car thief was for his actions. One group was told that he had a genetic oversensitivity to pain. The other group was not given that detail. The people in the group who were told that the man was oversensitive to pain held him less responsible for his action. Victim signaling is more common among those with the so-called dark triad personality traits of narcissism, Machiavellianism, and psychopathy. In one study, participants who strongly identified with statements of victimization like, "I have fewer opportunities presented to me than other people," were more likely to lie about whether they correctly guessed a coin flip, a lie that they knew would reward them $1. They were also more likely to agree with statements like, "If I knew I could never get caught, I would be willing to steal $1 million. And, researchers find, groups using victim signaling are more likely to seek retribution in violent conflicts. Victim signalers are more likely to boast of their victim status after being accused of discriminating against others or of being privileged. And so-called virtuous victims, people who broadcast their morality alongside their victimization, are more likely to gain resources from others, researchers find, and display dark triad personality traits than victim signalers who did not signal their virtue. Nobody in the gay community rejected victimology more than Harvey Milk. Before running for office, he owned and managed a small camera shop in the Castro neighborhood. But his passion was community organizing, and he became known as the mayor of Castro Street. Publicity of open and sometimes flamboyant homosexuality in places including the Castro in San Francisco, West Hollywood in Southern California, and Greenwich Village in New York was met with a backlash. In 1977, a beauty queen, singer, and television pitchwoman for Orange Juice successfully repealed a gay rights law in Florida, inspiring anti-gay activism nationwide. The same year, Dan White ran for the Board of Supervisors on a morality platform. He had become famous as a firefighter after saving a mother and baby from a burning building. White condemned the cesspool of perversion in San Francisco. "I am not going to be forced out of San Francisco by splinter groups of radicals, social deviants, and incorrigibles." The next year, 1978, a California state senator put an initiative on the ballot to ban gay teachers from California schools. He called San Francisco the moral garbage dump of homosexuality in this country. In the summer and fall of 1978, as Milk and his allies campaigned against the initiative, violence against gay and lesbian people rose. Young men started attacking gay people in the Castro neighborhood with knives and fists. In the summer of 1977, four teenagers jumped a gay couple walking to one of their apartments. A 19-year-old man pinned one of the men to the ground and stabbed him repeatedly in the chest with a fishing knife while screaming, "Faggot, faggot, faggot." In the Castro, gay men started carrying whistles to sound the alarm in case someone tried to attack them. When Milk heard a whistle blow one night, he ran toward it. Milk, a veteran of the U.S. Navy, saw the perpetrator, chased him, and tackled him. The man begged Milk not to hurt him. Milk growled at the man, "Tell all your friends we're down here waiting for them." On another occasion, Milk asked a reporter, "Do you think gay people are going to go with their heads bowed into the gas chambers? I mean, I'll go kicking and screaming before I go with my head bowed." Milk's work paid off. He and his allies mobilized thousands of people for grassroots outreach. With Mayor Moscone, Milk persuaded Governor Jerry Brown to oppose the proposition. Jerry Brown got President Jimmy Carter to oppose it, and so too did Ronald Reagan. In the end, the initiative was defeated 58-42. Milk and his burgeoning movement appeared to have played the decisive role. The 16th Street BART stop in San Francisco was an open-air drug scene in the late 1990s. Young heroin addicts, almost all white, would sometimes ask me for money as I walked by. I was often struck by how genuinely friendly they sounded when asking me for money, and also how hostile they became as soon as I said sorry and shrugged my shoulders. They were only playing the victim in the hope that I would play the role of rescuer. Homelessness researcher Teresa Gowan discovered the same dynamic. Many panhandlers, especially white panhandlers, presented themselves as helpless victims of homelessness, trying to get themselves together, noted Gowan. In effect, they had learned to use sick talk in a purely instrumental way, evoking depression, HIV, and various physical injuries as their primary obstacles to a normal life. The anger of many homeless often lies just beneath the surface. "Panhandling, it wasn't easy," a homeless man told Gowan. "You get to hate the people marching past. I used to give people this intense look, just say, 'Please, anything helps.' I figured people should like that, showing you're not fussy, you'll take the pennies. The thing is, after a while, you hate them, you hate everyone, and they feel it, they know." The game puts the homeless in the role of the child and the rest of society in the role of parent. The homeless kids were telling us overwhelmingly, "We want you to bring the services to us," said one San Francisco homeless service provider. "So we had a couple of supplies on us and would go up to kids and offer them. In a way, it was utterly natural. 'How are you doing? Do you need some socks tonight? Do you need a snack tonight?'" Such helping-only strategies provoke a strong reaction from people in recovery from addiction. "Every time I hear somebody say, 'Well, I just want to help people,' I want to punch them in the face," said Vicky Westbrook. Those are the people that are usually harming the people the most. How so? I asked. Because they're the ones that let people off the hook, or they just want to make sure they have everything they need. But they're not giving them their life back. Thank you for keeping them alive. I'm sure they need to eat. Give them some clean clothes and some clean socks and keep them warm. Can you do something that will really help get their life back? Is this what we're helping them do? Live on the streets for the next 20 years till they die? What kind of life is that? Stanford University addiction specialist Keith Humphreys agreed. There's a lot of people who have been really hurt by addicted people, he said, and people in the addiction field haven't wanted to cope with this. Sometimes the field screams at people, "How dare you have negative feelings about addicts?" But people are thinking, "I buried my child and I'm supposed to apologize?" Or, "My nose had to be reset 3 times until I got a restraining order, and you want me to feel bad for the guy who did it?" We don't honor that rage and pain, and the addiction field doesn't either. They just say you're not allowed to feel this way, and if you understood the neuroscience, it wouldn't bother you that your nose was broken 3 times. Toward the end of our conversation, I asked San Francisco's overdose prevention coordinator, Kristen Marshall, "What do you say to people who say it's been made too easy to use hard drugs in San Francisco?" Marshall chuckled ruefully. "Depends on what you mean by easy," she said. People who ask questions like that have very little understanding of what life is like in poverty and trauma and generations in poverty. Those critiques are coming from the people who haven't lived any semblance of the life of the people we've served. Except that they're not. In fact, some of the harshest critiques of radical harm reduction and drug decriminalization are coming from people like Tom Wolfe, Vicky Westbrook, and Jabari Jackson, who suffered from and overcame trauma, addiction, and homelessness. In the spring of 2016, I visited a very poor community in Delhi, India, whose residents made their livelihoods by picking through garbage for recyclable materials. Even wearing a mask, I could not spend more than a few minutes near the large dump where the people spent hours without masks. My guide was a former schoolteacher in her mid-30s named Anandita. When we arrived at the community, a circle was formed around a boy who appeared to be about 12 years old. He looked glum. Anandita talked to somebody in Hindi and then walked over to the boy. She spoke to him in a stern voice, like she was scolding him. She then walked out of the circle and back to me. "What was that all about?" I asked. "His mother died of tuberculosis last night," she said. "Oh, that's terrible," I said. "But why were you scolding him?" "He didn't go to school," she said. While shocking to me, such harsh discipline was common in the United States and other developed nations 100 years ago. Sociologists date changes to parenting styles to the transition from farm to city life in the 19th and 20th centuries. Urban couples needed far fewer children, and indeed could not take care of as many children as when they lived on farms. The quantity of chores expected of children declined dramatically, and has continued to decline. Concerns that parents were spoiling their children rose after World War II. Mothers mostly stayed home to engage in parenting, and parents, teachers, and others who work with children became significantly softer and gentler with them. Spanking and other forms of corporal punishment declined. Child-rearing expert Dr. Benjamin Spock taught that children should be permitted to develop at their own pace, not pushed to meet the schedules and rules of adult life. Eventually, the overprotective mother became a stereotype. The philosophical roots of coddling culture lie in the 1762 book Émile, by Jean-Jacques Rousseau, which argued that children are born good and that their education should be largely self-directed. The philosophy was a break from the older Christian idea that we are born with original sin and must develop the internal discipline required to resist our sinful desires. His idea was embraced in the 1960s by the New Bohemians. They believed in salvation by the child, which held that we can only realize our full potential by getting back in touch with what some called our innocent inner child, changing our child rearing, and changing our educational system. Parents today follow the thinking advanced by Rousseau without knowing it when they treat their children as natural, pure, and fragile, requiring as little discipline or strictness as possible. The hippie ideology was premised on being kind, wrote University of California sociologist Henry Miller. They wanted to love and be loved. Some parents in the hate in the 60s followed the Summerhill method of child rearing, which advocated a Rousseauian hands-off approach. In its most extreme form, hippie parents let their children be in the house without diapers because that was supposedly their natural state. As the children grew older, parents encouraged them to follow your bliss, telling them that they could grow up to be and do anything, giving enlarging self-importance, but also increasing their need for affirmation, admiration, and recognition. Today, researchers studying families around the world, from Italy and Sweden to Samoa and Peru, find that American families are outliers in how much they spoil and coddle their children. In other societies, school-aged children are expected to be vigilant and see what needs to be done around the house, and they routinely do chores without being asked, said the lead researcher of one study. But here, in middle-class mainstream households, you can't ask kids to do anything. In the 1990s, parents started giving out participation trophies to members of the losing sides of youth sports teams so they wouldn't feel sad. As children receive trophies and praise for mere participation rather than achievement, noted researchers, they value these rewards less, perform worse, and are more likely to suffer from depression. And many young men took longer to grow up, which some psychologists describe as the primary neurosis of our time. We give the phenomenon names like man-child and Peter Pan syndrome and apathy. Additionally, children today spend less time on self-directed creative play as opposed to time spent with electronic devices, or in structured activities organized by adults. Less free play means children are deprived of opportunities to dose themselves with risk, notes a psychologist. Instead of enjoying a healthy amount of risk, this generation is more likely than earlier ones to avoid it. The number of adolescents who agreed with the statement, "I get a real kick out of doing things that are a little dangerous," declined from over 50% to 43% between 1991 and 2015. One can grow up coddled, go to an elite university, and land in a job, all without much suffering or risk, and even with a significant amount of pampering. These institutions keep them insulated from much of the world, and the next thing you know, they're a senior person in their field, noted one entrepreneur. They have resources, they have influence, but they've never actually worked outside of a pretty sheltered context. Now, with the rise of remote work and delivery apps, many of us do not even need to go into the office and can live like only the super rich a generation ago could live, with workers delivering groceries, meals, and consumer products to our doorstep. The culture of coddling contributed to the opioid epidemic, some believe. Patients suffering pain felt more confidence demanding opioids while refusing to accept responsibility. Noted one author, patients were getting used to demanding drugs for treatment. They did not, however, have to accept the idea that they might, say, eat better and exercise more, and that this might help them lose weight and feel better. Doctors, of course, couldn't insist, and patients didn't have to take accountability for their own behavior. OxyContin was seen as vastly more effective than existing painkillers. Across the United States, unscrupulous doctors set up pill mills to give out prescriptions for opioids to people who didn't need them. Companies used deceptive marketing. They convinced doctors, regulators, and patients that the prescribing of opioids to treat chronic pain long-term was a safe and effective treatment. Until the scale of the problem became clear, it was difficult for doctors to refuse to prescribe opioids to patients who expected instant pain relief. Though the newly popular opioids carried little risk of addiction for most patients, they could have devastating effects on those already in the habit of self-medicating their emotional pain with other substances. And patients who did not become addicted themselves sometimes stored their medications in places where those more vulnerable to addiction, particularly teens, could find them. The problem is that creating a good life for oneself, one's family, and one's community requires denying or delaying gratification. Getting an education and maintaining a job means setting aside pursuing immediate happiness in favor of investing in satisfaction later. Raising children, particularly for parents who attempt to establish discipline, is hard. Somewhere along the way, many parents and the wider society stopped passing this message on to their children. Lack of discipline to delay gratification makes people fragile. The social workers told Vicky, "We don't want to push them too much and then they fail. Then they're going to think about failing." Too few social workers have the right attitude, says Vicky. "I can't tell you how many arguments I've gotten into with case managers, especially if they're licensed clinicians, because they're client-centered, client-driven. They say things to me like, 'Well, you know this person has substance use.' That's the end of their sentence. I'm like, 'Okay, and what's next?' That can't be the end of the story." The politics of victimology undermines our freedom and threatens us all. Losing faith in your own willfulness and capacity to act, you eventually lose freedom, noted an early critic of victim culture. That was one lesson of totalitarianism, which succeeded by organizing masses of the disaffected, politically inactive, self-centered people who felt helpless and victimized, believed that they didn't matter, and sought self-abandonment in the state. It also makes more victims. By not prosecuting the drug dealers, whom District Attorney Boudin describes as victims of human trafficking, he ends up allowing the victimization of people of color, the poor, and the mentally ill, who are the very victims that progressives claim they want to protect. Thinking back to Anadita's scolding of the boy who lost his mother, do we think her behavior was cruel? By today's progressive standards, yes. If a Berkeley mother behaved similarly toward a 12-year-old boy who had just lost a parent, she would be ostracized. The boy would be viewed as doubly victimized. However, a boy who gives up on school in that community of trash pickers practically dooms himself to breathe toxic garbage for the rest of his shortened life. By scolding the boy and making him as afraid of her as he was sad about his mother, Anandita did the compassionate thing. In Amsterdam in the fall of 2019, after my morning with René Jagirisch, I visited the Rijksmuseum. I was struck by the juxtaposition of art in two separate rooms. One was full of large, action-oriented paintings of Dutchmen and gunboats at war with their enemies. The other room was of paintings of tranquil family life. I was captivated by one painting in particular, of a very wealthy family with classic round Dutch heads, each person holding a musical instrument. The Netherlands was the first country in the modern world to become fabulously wealthy. That wealth, and the great city of Amsterdam itself, were only possible through military security and force, which is something we tend to forget when we are making music with our families at home. I met a Dutch friend for tea that evening. I told him about my experience with René, his insistence on balancing carrots and sticks, and the contrasting rooms at the Rijksmuseum. He smiled and nodded. "We have an expression," which he said in Dutch. "It means," here he paused and looked up, "soft doctors make wounds stink." Does that make sense? Do you mean doctors who are so afraid to hurt their patients fail to properly clean wounds and they become infected and stink? Yes, he said. Do you have that expression in the U.S.? I told him we didn't, but that perhaps we should. Jabari, Tom, and Vicky all stressed that great social workers are both loving and tough. My drug treatment specialist in prison was too much, said Vicky Westbrook. She was a correctional officer before she was a treatment counselor. I did not like this woman. But I'll tell you what, I hear that woman in my head. When I'm doing something and I'm like, oh my God, this sucks, I hear her go, Vicky, that's where the growth is. Get excited, that's where the growth is. I'm like, okay, that's where the growth. You know what I'm saying? I love that woman because of the things that still go on in my head because of that. People need help setting the right goals and creating a plan to achieve them, which is what empowered caseworkers using assertive case management would do. The problem isn't setting the bar too high and not meeting it, said Vicky. It's setting it too low and meeting it. People can't imagine what's possible for them. When homeless men pursue their goals through hard work, they express happiness. I know this sounds weird, said Spike, one of the homeless men Gowan followed, but I am happier doing this shit, collecting bottles and cans for recycling, than I have been in years. You get such a sense of achievement out of it. Set off in the morning with nothing, then you find all this cool stuff, and people even appreciate what you're doing half the time. It's like I get high from it, a real buzz. But it is a buzz that lasts, not some quick high. It puts me in a good mellow mood all day, especially when the weather is good. I'm starting to see what I've been missing out on in my life. It wasn't until Vicky's partner, Raven, didn't have Vicky to depend upon that he pulled his own life together. By the time I got out of prison, his landscaping business was thriving, Vicky said. He has contracts with apartment complexes and has a team, a crew, and a truck. I feel like that happened partly because I wasn't around, because he would have been more dependent on me to take care of stuff. I still do some of his stuff, but as far as taking care of the business, invoicing and putting in bids and things like that, that's all him. I think it was a struggle for him at first, too. Becoming a hero means taking responsibility for what one did in the past. I've just destroyed people's lives with some of the actions that I've done, Jabari told me. It's not cool, man, it's not cool. Because if somebody did that to me and mine, I'd be ready to kill somebody for doing that to me and mine. Who the fuck am I to walk around here and gloat that I did that to the next person? With every action comes recourse from it, and I understand that. Vicky felt the same. I was really ashamed of what I had done to my community. I sold drugs to people that weren't really taking care of their kids. I would justify it. Their kids could come to my house and eat. I was so good, but bitch, you shouldn't have been selling drugs to them. That was taking food out of, you know what I'm saying? That's that thing you do when you're an addict. You make justifications and twist things around to make it look like what you want it to look like. For Jabari and Vicky, learning different forms of psychotherapy was liberating. It gave them awareness and a sense of control over their trauma. I asked Jabari if his recovery was focused around the 12-step program. You know what, he said, I'm a sponge. I do 12-step, I do attack therapy, because different ones work for me in different ways. What's attack therapy, I asked. Attack therapy is behavioral modification, he said. It's not harm reduction. They'll call you on your shit. They're going to tell you when you're doing wrong. When you're trying to minimize stuff and manipulate something, they're going to call you on it. If people continue to call me on my shit, yeah, it breaks me out of that mode and that habit. Vicky said her drug recovery, including her time in prison, improved her life in ways beyond sobriety. My life was bigger in prison than it had been when I was out on the streets using and dealing, she said. What do you mean by bigger? I asked. More expansive, she said. Possibility, experience. I had a job in prison. I was doing all these classes. I was a leader in my treatment community. I was helping other women, so much more robust of a life than I had then. That never would have happened if I kept using. Over time, Paniz Kasserian overcame the physical attack. I went through a very dark year, she said. PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is dark. I was blocking feelings. I couldn't do anything for a long time. I had to learn to not let that incident define who I am. I learned that this is life, things happen. It's in the past, I survived. It almost sounds like you're saying the attack made you a better person, I said. I am a better person now, Paniz said. I understand and appreciate life more. I was a little shallow, I was a little spoiled. I appreciate what I have more. I understood that leading with love suits me better, regardless of what they do to me. I became more spiritual, more calm, more centered. There are a lot of things I can't control. I can only control my actions. And now I know that if, God forbid, something bad happens again, I won't be as affected. Heroism is not the absence of victimization, but the overcoming of it. Thanks to his intense commitment to recovery, including honesty with himself, Jabari Jackson today is in a healthy romantic relationship. Today, for the first time in my life, I have a wonderful, beautiful, healthy relationship, he said. I have a woman in my life that filled the needs of my life that I hadn't even imagined that I needed. And it makes this journey all the way easier than it was before. It makes me realize things of who I am and who I want to be. Jabari is taking responsibility for a child he didn't know he had. I found out that I have a 10-year-old daughter who was conceived through my times out there in the field, he said. I found out through the DMV because child support was trying to come get me. She's beautiful. Me and her mother are best of friends, and my romantic girl has a 13-year-old son, and so we have a family now. The psychotherapeutic philosophies and techniques that belonged to a tiny elite of psychotherapists in the 1960s are today so prevalent that they constitute the positive alternative morality to victimology. I like the 12 Steps program because the steps helped me get closer with my spirituality, said Jabari. And I like to hear the stories of other people. It builds a community. The 12-step program and other drug recovery efforts help people accept the ways in which they were initially shaped by their parents, neighborhoods, and other circumstances, but then overcame them. You let that shit go when you work the 12 steps, if you do it right, a former addict told Gowan. It's no good looking outside of you, and it's no use blaming. For me, I had to accept that my mother was an addict, and I have always been an addict since I was a little kid. Toward the end of our interview, Jabari struck a similarly stoic note. I don't want nobody to go through the shit that I've been through, he said. I'm not disgraced and I'm not ashamed of the shit I've done. I don't condemn myself anymore. If I wouldn't have got past them times, if it wasn't for those things, I wouldn't be where I am today. All of us must evolve beyond the helping only, or incarceration only, approach toward a more balanced, tough love. And goal-setting one. If you just give a carrot, said Renee, you get spoiled people. If you give an addicted person just the carrots, you'll be addicted. But if you treat them both ways, it gives them space to change. It gives them space to recognize their problems and to see that there are ways to solve those problems. Jabari today has achieved peace with his past. I truly, truly feel that my experiences are life lessons, he said. If I could turn around and tell my life lessons to the next person so they don't go through this shit that I've been through, that's all what matters to me, man. Because it's time for me to give back to the family, friends, and the community that I've taken so much from, that I've destroyed. Vicky's time in prison, particularly her psychology training and her personal journey, allows her to see through the lies her substance-abusing clients told her. They couldn't run game on me because I had already been there, she said. I would have young dealers coming in trying to make changes, and they come into my office suited. I'm like, dude, I got you your job. I know how much money you make. This is not $20 an hour. Stop doing that. You can't have a foot in both worlds. They're like, no, mom, not doing it. Then, I don't know, a week and a half later, I'd find them somewhere slinging dope in the city. I was like, man, you don't got to lie to me. You got to make a decision. I worked with people on a very different kind of level than I think they were used to sometimes, said Vicky. I don't deal in this is right and this is wrong. I deal with, like, tell me where you want to go, and I'm going to tell you what supports that goal and what doesn't. If it doesn't support that goal, then you're either lying to me or yourself, or you need to knock it off and let's do something to get to where you really want to go, said Humphreys. The only people who get the hurt caused by addiction are the 12-step people. They all get that part of getting better is atoning for the shit things you did against this sort of lefty view that no one should have to apologize. The 12-step people know that if you pass out at your daughter's 12th birthday and humiliate her, and she gets made fun of for the next 5 years, you have to apologize. They get that. You can't just say, it's a brain disease, honey. Stop being angry. But there isn't a more broad way to let people atone without punishing them horrifically. And so we handle it by throwing them in prison and ruining their lives, which doesn't make us feel better either.